There comes a moment when the child becomes the parent, the student becomes the teacher, the seeker becomes the guide. We spend the first part of the journey just trying to make sense of the map, exploring the territory, honing our instincts, until the time comes to pay it forward to the next generation. You might get help to point you in the right direction, sure, but nobody can tell you exactly how to get home. Each of us has to find that path ourselves, and no matter how far we think we've come, there's always further to go. Until, of course, one day we go all the way home. And that is, in general terms, the story of humanity itself. Our wisdom is collective, but our experience is unique. And we might be inclined to believe that our own experience is somehow more unique than that of others we meet along the road, but humility will forever remain our greatest strength. Because, as Terry Lynn Carrington will tell you, only an open hand receives. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Terry Lynn Carrington started playing drums as a child in Boston. By the time she was 10 years old, she was gigging with Clark Terry. At 11, she had a drum endorsement, and by 20, she was already building a remarkable career. By 30 years old, she had worked with Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, two of the most visionary artists of their generation. Check her out playing at 16 years old on the album TLC and Friends. Today, she's a Grammy Award-winning drummer, composer, producer, educator, and activist whose trailblazing career spans over four decades. She's worked with an extraordinary range of artists, including, of course, Herbie and Wayne, and also Esperanza Spalding, Cassandra Wilson, Diane Reeves, and many more. She's the first woman to win a Grammy for Best Jazz Instrumental Album. In 2021, she became an NEA Jazz Master. She's had an extraordinary life in music. But what strikes me most is how deeply she reflects on her role in the ecosystem as a performer and composer and as someone who is actively shaping the future. At the Berklee College Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice, which she founded, she's helping a new generation imagine what jazz can be, not just who plays it, but how it sounds and what it stands for. We spoke on the occasion of her new record, We Insist 2025. It's a collaboration with vocalist Christy DeShiel and a bold reimagining of Max Roach's seminal 1960 protest suite. The original We Insist was a rallying cry during the civil rights movement.
Drive a man he made a life, but the mammy ain't his wife. Chopping cotton, don't be slow. Better finish out your row.
This version is something different.
Keep a moving with that cloud.
An invitation to engage with today's struggle for equity, identity, and freedom.
Show you how. You get to work and root that stump. Drive a man will make you.
Terry Lynn talks about sound and silence, about leaving steady gigs to bet on herself, about being one of the few women in jazz drumming for decades, how that shaped her, and what she's learning to unlearn. She's honest about the burden of self-imposed pressure, the evolution of her teaching philosophy, and what it means to hear the humanity in someone's playing, even when they themselves are personally complicated. This episode is a conversation about music, but also about the deeper work, the stuff that lives under the surface, the choices we make, the systems we inherit, and the ones we build. Third-story.com is the place to find the full archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, including some of Terry Lynn's friends and collaborators like Matt Stevens, Casa Overall, and Aaron Parks, plus a long list of other drummers, including Gregory Hutchinson, Nate Smith, Mark Juliana, Micaiah McCraven, J.R. Robinson, Bill Stewart, Eric Harland, and many more. And check out leosidran.substack.com for the latest episodes and musings. I love it over there, and I think you will too. Don't forget, we're made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more award-winning content. Here's me and Terry Lynn Carrington talking it down. Hi, Terry Lynn. You know, we're talking in advance of this record that's coming out, and we can talk about a lot of things, but the fact is you were in, as I understand it, in Abu Dhabi a couple of days ago. We're talking on a Sunday afternoon. You have a lot of balls in the air, and just in a general sense, I would love for you to talk about what you do in a given day or week.
Wow. Not really the best manager of my own time. I do my best. I think that the artist in me tends to throw the balls up in the air and catch what I can, and somehow I catch most of them. But I've never been that type of rigid person, you know, so I take on a lot of things and let the creative moment inspire me and let my inclinations inspire me to do the things that I do. It's not a science, put it like that.
You're teaching, you're a band leader, you're a mentor, you have all these projects that you're putting into action, but you talk about letting the creative moment lead. Is there any kind of transformation that has to happen when the creative moment happens, like to silence all the noise of all the responsibility and just like focus in on the music?
Well, I look at it all as being creative. I also do A&R for a label. I consult for a legacy artist. So there's a lot of different things. It's all related to this particular music industry. But I guess I do have to quiet all the noise when I'm writing and preparing somehow, you know, to perform. But mostly when I'm writing, because the part about preparing to perform would mean practicing. And that's the part that I haven't really done since I was 20 or so. So I look toward the day when I can really spend some time practicing again.
You haven't really been practicing since you were 20, but you did all this incredible work from the time you were, what, 7, 10? When did you get your first drum set from your grandfather?
Yeah, that's 7. I played his drums, and then I got my first endorsement when I was 11 with Slingerland drums, because Buddy Rich invited me to play with him, and then they sent me a replica of his drum set.
Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was of first interacting with the drums as a 7-year-old girl, 8 years old, little kid? I mean, like, did you take to it? How did this happen?
I don't fully remember because it was just always there, I guess. So at 7, I just don't have really strong memories. I do remember it being fun and my dad encouraging me. Me asking, you know, if I could play, because he would set the drums up for himself to play. And I think once I showed like I had an aptitude for it, he really was encouraging. And I think that that's really the thing that made the difference for me and the thing that can make the difference for so many young people trying to play music.
Would the two of you play together? He was a saxophone player, right?
Yeah, we would play together. But he knew everybody, so he would take me to the clubs and introduce me to people, and we would tell them that I could play, and they would believe him, so they would want to hear it. And I would sit in with just everybody. I mean, there's more people I sat in with, of big name people that you would know, than the ones I didn't.
You end up with a proper gig with Clark Terry by the time you're like 10 or 11 years old.
I don't know if it was proper. I was a guest with his East Coast, West Coast jazz giants. When I was 10, yeah. So that was at the Wichita, Kansas Jazz Festival. Diane Reeves was a guest as well. So I was 10, she was 19. She's my longest friend. And then when I moved to New York, I left Berkeley when I was 18 and moved to New York about 5 or 6 months before my 19th birthday. And Clark basically told me that I had a gig waiting for me when I moved to New York. So I started going to Europe and touring and gigging with him.
You know, I appreciate you saying you don't have a memory of what that was like when you were 7 or 8 years old with the drums, because what I take away from that is that you really probably don't have a memory that doesn't include the drums.
Correct.
It's an unusual story, let's be honest. It doesn't happen to everybody where they find this thing that they love so young and that they're so good at.
Yeah, it is an unusual story. I like to say that I had a very charmed childhood, and I think it really just speaks to, if somebody shows an interest in something, you know, whether it's a parent or a sibling or a relative or a friend, somehow nurturing someone's interest and helping them, you know, find this wind beneath their wings, so to say, it does wonders. I had that example. So many of the people that I've met, both young men and young women, have not had the same kind of support and experiences that I had. So once I realized that, I felt like I needed to do more to help, their trajectory be a little easier.
There are certainly stories of people that come young. Tony Williams was very young. I mean, there are plenty of people that we know of today, maybe more. I think sometimes maybe there are more that we're aware because of the internet. So you can have somebody anywhere on the planet. We're aware of them all over the world very quickly. Whereas you had to physically, first of all, you had access. You had, your father knew people, and then you had to move around. And you were growing up in a city full of musicians. But I mean, if you're growing up anywhere in any corner of the planet today, you could still be sort of discovered or find that community. But in your generation, to be a young woman, to be female, was not common at all.
I wasn't thinking about it back then. I was cognizant that it brought me some opportunities because it was a novelty to some people. And that didn't really bother me because I think we all have to take the opportunities, as they come. My job was to be ready for them. And as far as, the internet definitely changed everything. And you can see so many young people that have talent, whereas before, it was just hard to know where they were unless there were circumstances that brought them, to the forefront. So I was lucky to have those circumstances that brought me to the forefront. But, it's funny, my dad, when he watches, these young people playing whatever instrument on the internet, he always says to me, "Good thing you came along when you did." And I always look at him like, "Wow, you don't have any faith that I would have made it if I came along now." I try to tell him that if I had come along with the same tools that all these kids came along with, then I would be a different musician. I would, I still believe that I would have excelled because I would have had more tools, more things to work with.
More technical tools.
Like just everything's faster, right? More information. I had to sit there and watch these drummers and try to, or listen to the records, right? And just try to, grab what I could or sit and watch.
I think that's so funny, though, that you said, I had to sit there and watch these drummers. I would frame that as, I got to sit there and watch these drummers. I mean, what you had was the oral history. You had it directly handed down to you.
Yeah, but all my point is that now you could go on the internet and watch closely damn near anybody you want. You're right, that I should have phrased it differently. I had to be in the space and do it. Now you don't, so you can see more.
But in terms of less of the technical question and more of the sort of the mentorship aspect of it, like it does seem that you caught, it's not the tail end of it because you're carrying it forward and there are plenty of people that are carrying on this idea of mentorship. But it seems like as you describe being taken physically to all these drummers and they all saw you and they all dealt with you, you got that thing that we hear about today, but it's maybe harder to come by because so many people that generation are no longer with us. You got to know all those, innovators and those masters from that generation before you.
Yeah, absolutely. The culture has changed too. I mean, because of the internet, people, they're not making the same relationships. Like, for whatever it's worth, I mean, I'm right here at Berkeley with a lot of people that could be up under me, that aren't really trying to be. It's a different culture now, and I think people spend more time alone practicing and, working a certain kind of way. And when we were younger, we would do anything. I remember driving in a really bad snowstorm to just to take Dizzy Gillespie to the train station, from his hotel, where he could have got a taxi. But just to have 15 minutes or 20 minutes in the car with him was important. It's different now.
So you say there's so many people that could be up under you. You mean there's people there that have access to you, you teach there, you're available, and you feel that they're not necessarily all coming to you for all of
There are some, don't get me wrong, there are some that are getting their education,
it.
but there's people that they're around a lot of great people and they're either used to it or they don't understand sometimes the value in the things that aren't necessarily just the technical aspect of playing music.
Yes.
Like Jack DeJohnette, for instance, is my mentor, one of my biggest mentors. And I went to his house a lot, drove up state New York from the time I could drive. But he never gave me a lesson, not like a sit-down drum lesson. You know what I mean? It was just being around him and talking and getting inspired and getting his insight and his view, and him, telling me to listen to this music or check out this record or let's listen to this or taking me to Burning Spear concert or Sweet Honey in the Rock concert or a Keith Jarrett solo piano concert. I'm just remembering in the places I went, a solo guitar concert. Actually, it was Keith Jarrett with a string quartet and Kenny Burrell's solo guitar concert. Like I'm just remembering things that I would not have done if it weren't for him and his wife. But me being willing to just try things and do whatever. Yeah, even the first Yellow Jackets album he turned me on to,
You think you can learn about a musician by dealing with them as a person on the human level?
Yeah, I think you can learn something, yeah, about them and their artistry, because I don't think art and life are separate. So, yeah, it goes hand in hand. But I do think that some people are working through something. Like they can be a different person and their artistry be very different than who they are as a person because maybe they're allowing their artistry to be therapy for them, and they're able to work through some things. And there's other people that it's really a direct correlation.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, I'm always tempted to think that the more beautiful, if I think somebody plays beautifully, they must just be the be most beautiful person to be around. And I've certainly had experiences where they're different, like the music still touches me, but the personal energy is a little harsher or a little whatever, they're not always exactly the same.
Right. And then it forces you to look at their humanity, look at your own, and have compassion and empathy and all of these things because you know that that potential is there for them because you hear it in their music. And so it forces you to understand something about them and not be judgmental or try not to be, because, sometimes we are. I end up trying to have compassion for the, especially for the very people that really annoy the crap out of me. I try to have compassion for them because I also try to look at it as a mirror. Like, what is it about them that I find so annoying? And what is that showing me about myself?
Sometime in your early 20s, you moved to the West Coast and you end up playing on television, among other things. You end up playing in the band on the Arsenio Hall show when you're in your early 20s. It's kind of an historic gig looking back on it. I mean, that was like a major moment in television. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, we felt it, we felt it was a major moment culturally, especially, in the Black community,
Yeah.
because we had not had a TV show yet, a late night TV show yet. So this was really a big deal. And what's funny is I was really only on the show for the first 4 or 5 months. But people, they didn't realize that. People remember me from it because it was the beginning. And people really still relate me to that show when I was not there nearly as long as the second drummer.
Yeah.
But I feel like people relate me more to it. You know what I mean? And because it was such a historic moment. And we all look back and say, wow, that happened.
Yeah.
But then 10 years later, I did the Quincy Jones Vibe TV show.
You're right. Was that Sinbad was the host?
Yeah, he was the second host, but he was the one that I think we came away with feeling like it was his show.
You weren't on Arsenio when Bill Clinton played, were you?
Nope.
You were already gone by then. Why did you leave so quickly?
I didn't want to. I made this record. The label was pretty heavy-handed in asking me to promote this record. So I asked the show if I could take 2 weeks off to promote it at two different times, like not 2 weeks in a row, but a week. And come back for a week or two and then another week. And, get like some really cool all-star drummers to sub. And they said yes. And then, I don't know, a couple of days, a few days before, they said, we want you to be 100% committed to the show. So at that point, all this other stuff had been planned. So I had a choice at that moment to stay on the show or to go, you know, with the promotion for my album as planned. And I really don't know, honestly, what made me choose to go, other than I think I didn't like being put in a position like between a rock and a hard place. I fight back. I had to do some soul searching for that one because I was leaving a steady check. And, you know, the notoriety, I'm not going to lie, it felt good. So I was like, I don't know where I'm going from here. But I think there was always something in me that would say, always bet on yourself. Mm-hmm.
I think on the one hand, when you're young, you have a lot of future ahead of you. But on the other hand, when you're young, you're in a hurry more, you know? So like, I could imagine you saying, I have my own career. I have my record. I need to do this. I can't not promote my record, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't probably make that decision now.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah. I think when you're young, you also have another viewpoint. You think things are going to come back around. Like even when I was nominated for that album that I was promoting, got nominated for a Grammy. And I didn't win, of course. It was against Miles Davis, Larry Carlton, Pat Metheny, and John Patitucci. So I kind of went in knowing I wasn't going to win. I think Pat Metheny won. But I felt there was no place in me that thought I wouldn't get nominated again or that I wouldn't, you know, be able to come back and try again with the next one. But then I got shelved for, gosh, I didn't make another record for 15 years or something like that. So it was funny because I just didn't see that coming. But I was working, you know, working with great people, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, you know.
Right. So you end up working with Herbie and Wayne and you get this incredible school among the greats of not only music, but I would imagine also what it looks like to be in an organization like that, to play in somebody's band like that. I'm curious how much you talk about, how much you don't, how much freedom and flexibility, how much of the choice is made just once you've selected the musicians that you want to work with. I mean, what did you learn through all those years, particularly with Herbie, in all those iterations of his bands that maybe had an influence on you when you started to, you know, run your own bands again?
It's interesting. I'm not sure what makes somebody a good band leader. The thing with both Herbie and Wayne is they didn't tell you a lot. They just trusted your instincts. If I recommended players, they would just hire them almost without hearing them. Because, you know, it's not the same, right? You weren't going on the internet, like checking out somebody. It would be a whole thing if somebody's sending you a cassette or whatever. So it was a lot of trust. When I started leading bands, I was a little more attached to my own vision and really wanting things a certain way. But then sometimes I would let their influence, you know, come in and try to find that balance between your own vision and what other people have to offer. And also giving other people opportunity to shine, not just musically, but shine as a leader or potential leader as well.
Because of these interviews, I've talked to a small handful of people that have come through your band, people who, like, you can feel did kind of learn something through being in your band that then they took into their own projects or whatever, and that maybe you sort of fostered and let them develop inside of your own projects and they took it into whatever else they were doing.
Well, that's what it is, though. That's what it is on all levels. I mean, that's what you're doing when you teach. That's what you're doing when you band lead. It's just always about passing on the information that you have because that's how you got it. If you care about, you know, the music, then that's what you're going to do because you want to see it thrive and you want to see people thrive. And it doesn't take anything away from yourself.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't know any other way because it doesn't make sense. Like only an open hand receives.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, but you do have to find a balance because, you know, everybody has an ego. And everybody knows what they know. Like, I know that I know what I know. You know what I mean? Now, that doesn't mean I can't be taught or told things and that I'm not open to things. So it's like finding that balance of how much do I... Because you could just take in everything and then you never know anything.
Yeah.
Because you just... All this information coming at you and then you're not taking the time to make your own point of view.
If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's finding that balance. And it's just coming into your own as a human being, as a musician. It's a lifelong journey. It's nothing that starts and ends at any given time, unless you decide if you want to be that kind of musician or person for that matter, or get stuck, then.
Do you think starting so early like you did it force you to grow up quickly, or did it keep you younger longer?
No, that's interesting. I don't know. I never thought about that. Probably a bit of both, because the times were different, right? Like I moved to New York when I was 18. I'm not sure I would suggest that right now for most 18-year-old people that I meet. I'm not sure I would suggest, move to East Harlem. So, yeah, I think I grew up fast, but I was always around adults. So. Yeah. But I really enjoyed hanging out with friends, too. So, again, I was finding balance. I think I didn't know that's what I was doing, but I think I did do it because you do crave a certain kind of camaraderie, attention from your peers. But at the same time, in my case, I was getting a lot of praise from people a whole generation or two beyond me. But also, like you said, did it keep you young? I mean, I think so too, because some people still see me as a kid. So yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, older people. Yeah. So I think it does a bit of both.
But you did feel that you had peers, like you had, because I could also imagine that you were like, in a way, you were sort of peerless. You started so young. There are there are people out there. Maybe over the years you ran into other young, exceptional, prodigal people. But for the most part, you're kind of a one of one. Were you able to relate to your quote unquote peers?
When I say peers, probably people within 5-10 years older than me.
Yeah.
I would say peers are people that I went to school with. But I started coming to Berkeley at a younger age. So my peers, I would say are people a little older than me. And then once you get older, then your peers can be, people 5 years younger than you.
Yeah.
But for me at the time, when I lived in New York, I was hanging out with a certain kind of Brooklyn group, Jerry Allen, Cassandra Wilson, Greg Osby, Robin Eubanks. So those were all, even though they're all older than me, I look at them as peers.
Was that praise? You said you were getting a lot of praise from the generation ahead of you. Did that ever get into your head? Sometimes people, when they receive praise like that, it can kind of mess with your head a little bit. Did you feel like you had to live up to something, or that there was anything that was expected of you? Did it have any impact on you?
I mean, the biggest amount of pressure that I felt was from myself, not from these great people. Everybody was pretty gracious along the way. So I was always feeling, in the early days, I was always feeling like I wasn't quite up to snuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just like, I could have played better. I could have done this better. I could, it took me a while to just kind of be okay with bringing my best at any given moment and being okay with that. I mean, it was when I started playing with Wayne, and I was literally freaking out after every gig. And then he said something that stuck with me. He said, music is just a drop in the ocean of life. And that really kind of shifted things, because I realized I was putting too much attention on myself and, what I was doing. And then that I had to start thinking about it as a whole, as a group, as one sound, and kind of let go of whatever agenda I had that apparently I wasn't living up to in my own mind. So it was good to let go of that and just keep going, keep trying.
At some point, it seems like you realize that making music, although it may be a drop in the ocean of life, music can do more work than just be music. It can also be a form of advocacy. It can have political undertones. It can be a form of communicating a larger story. I mean, you started to use the music to tell other kinds of stories. What happened where you realized, I want to do more than just be playing gigs? I want to be using this platform to be a vehicle for something bigger.
I think the first thing was, if you say what I want to be doing more than just playing gigs, I think I recognized myself as a band leader. So I had to start creating opportunities to do that. So that was really the first step in focusing on having something to say.
Yeah.
And also teaching, they kind of came around the same time, I think. which, yeah, there's a correlation there somehow. And then realizing that you have a platform of some sort, whether how large or small it is, you have a platform. And what are you going to do with that? And really, is it at the end of the day just about you and the next gig, or, you know, how much money you're making, or which is important, you know, for survival. But I think often we know that there's something greater for us, you know, so a better way to contribute to the world. How do you help contribute to making a world that you want to live in? So if you start thinking like that, then you could see yourself as being hypocritical, because if I'm going to criticize anything, I have to look at myself. And what am I doing? You know, it's just like everybody wants to win a Grammy, but, you know, at the same time, everybody puts down the Grammys, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody has something to say and, you know, won't join, right? But then they want to win. So it's the same thing with anything. If you're going to be an advocate for something, and you don't have to do it through music. You can do it in your community.
Sure.
You can do it other ways. But I do think, especially at a certain stage of life, you're looking at your own legacy and what have you done other than make some good records or not so good records, you know?
Yeah. Well, and in a way, you're sort of doing it in both ways, in your community and in the music. This could be an opportunity for us to talk a little bit about the Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice, which I have to say is a tongue twister.
Oh, that's funny. I never even thought about it like that.
I mean, it swings, though. It's a tongue twister that swings. When you describe your own personal experience, as you say, if anything, being a woman was maybe a novelty that gave you opportunity because it was so rare. I don't hear from you that it stood in your way of being able to move forward through the world. But on the other hand, you know, you have really made an effort to elevate and amplify voices of female artists who wouldn't have had that same opportunity otherwise.
I think anybody that I've elevated or amplified in any way already had opportunity. You know, I can't take any sole responsibility for anything because it's all collective work. But that's, I think, that's the thing that we have to realize. And it's not the work of women. It's a collective work from everybody to make this kind of change happen. First of all, you have to want to change. You know, you have to see a problem. There's, you know, maybe some musicians that don't because they're just not willing to, you know, open up in that way. Or not just musicians, but people in the whole ecosystem or ecosystem. I never know which way to say that.
I think I was just, as you said it, I was like, I think it's good. Ecosystem. Well, actually, ecosystem is maybe, that's a more poetic thing. It's like we're in echo chamber. It's an ecosystem.
Yeah. And also it might depend on what side of the ocean you're on. But anyway, yeah, you have to recognize there's a problem. You have to want to see a change. You have to want to be a part of a change. And really, that's all we're talking about here. Recognizing that there's a problem, even if it didn't affect you. And I think for me, it took me a while to not see how I did things as a model for others.
Wait, talk about that a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, when I started teaching, I would just tell my female students, you know, just be good, just practice, just be better than everybody else. Oh, this happened? Well, just rub it off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go at it again.
Shake it off, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then I realized, well, that's not fair. That's not even a good way to teach. And because that was how I was. But you can't expect every woman to be the same, first of all, coming into this music. So I started looking at the personalities of all the successful women I know. And most of them have very strong personalities that would have no problem kind of going up against the next guy. But at the same time, you have to do that in a way that's not offensive to guys. So there's this kind of strength, but also a bit of femininity wrapped around it. And those were the most successful women I found. I mean, if I were to generalize.
But that's a very strategic approach. I mean, what you're saying is like, look, this is a thing, and there are ways to navigate it that will get you closer to what you need to get.
No, but I don't think it's strategic at all. I think it's how people are made. Because anybody trying to be that way, it's not going to work. You know what I mean? Like, you have to have a thick skin. You know, these are all these things, and you have to believe in yourself, and you have to have this part of you that wants to just get up and do it again and prove something along the way. You know what I mean? This is what I came to realize. You have to, you know, have a certain amount of humility, but also a fair amount of confidence. And now, if you were not raised to have that kind of confidence, then you're already starting off in a place that's very different from so many of the successful women that I know that were confident, you know, fairly young. I mean, I always tell this story about Buddy Rich when I first met him and I was 10, and they told me not to go up and talk to him because he was in a bad mood. I just went up to him anyway. And then when the person introduced me, it was like, I think guy from Zildjian introduced me. He snapped at me and he said, "Oh yeah, well, you better not be any good." Because they had said, "She's here playing with Clark Terry." And he said, "Well, you better not be any good." And I said, "Well, who's going to stop me?" And then he said, "Oh, you want to come play with my band?" So at 10 years old, I'm learning, oh, standing up for myself actually works. You know what I mean? I'm sure I learned other things, you know, that weren't that were the opposite of that. But I just feel like sometimes, you know, some people are born with a certain sense of self. Other people have really developed it because of their upbringing, you know, how their parents were, their family. Other people have to work at it.
Sure.
Throughout their life a little more than others maybe. So I think what came to me is that there's no cookie cutter woman trying to play jazz. And you can't expect everybody to navigate a situation the same way when they're a minority.
Well, right. So you said at the beginning of this part of the conversation, you know, some people maybe don't want to see that there's a problem, but there's a problem. And the only way to address the problem is to first acknowledge that there is a problem. Is the problem that women have been kept out of jazz, have been not encouraged as much to play it, that there wasn't as much opportunity, there was a lack of equity? What is the problem that is being solved?
There is no equity really to speak of in jazz performance unless you're a vocalist.
Yes.
So that's the problem that's really obvious, you know, to everybody. So the question that I ask on that note is, if you care about the music and, you know, its progression,
mm-hmm.
how could you not want to see mm-hmm. half of those people in the world contribute to it? How could you not feel that something could be missing when only a certain group of people contribute to something that you supposedly love?
Yes.
Because nobody's doing this if they don't love it. So how do we all just accept this as men's music? It's really, you know, phenomenal to me.
Yeah.
Because it's not. But we've all been fed this because of how it started, how it proliferated, and the whole thing. It's been a systemic issue from the very beginning. So we're just trying to kind of break down that system and really show how ridiculous it is. But more than that, the harder part is to be able to be open to hear how the sound of the music might expand when people can be their authentic selves, you know, performing it, composing it, whatever. Because everything that's been great in jazz has been made by a man. So now you have women that are great because they play like men. We don't know what women sound like. You know what I mean? We just don't know what a different aesthetic embedded in the music will bring. And so that's the big question.
I think it's a huge question also about to what extent whatever the factors of your identity are come out in the music and in the way you create. I mean, is there such a thing as playing like a man or like a woman? Or are we just
yes.
playing like ourselves? There is. Tell
well,
me.
That's, tell yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, this is the thing that we fight all the time because nobody wants to feel like they're playing like a man or a woman. Will we agree that women and men have different experiences in the world?
Absolutely.
Right. Then would we agree that there's no separation between art and life, or, you know, that art is a reflection of life?
Absolutely.
So then, of course, they're going to be in a different artistic expression. You know, there's a possibility of that. I mean, the stories, are we not telling stories when we perform and when we write music?
Hopefully.
Right. All these things
yeah.
point to a difference of experience. There's going to be a difference culturally. There's going to be a difference, you know, people born someplace else that always ate muesli for breakfast opposed to eggs and bacon. I don't know. You know, you see what I mean? So it's just, you know, we have to start looking at what, like I have to look at personally, what I squashed or just didn't pay attention to or deal with in my own playing or my own artistry.
Interesting.
I mean, would we also not agree that some form of hypermasculinity is embedded in jazz? Would we not agree to that?
I want to hear more about yes and, you know, I mean.
I'm just saying, in general, I don't mean just you. I just mean, I think any reasonable person that knows this music will be able to see, hear, feel a certain kind of masculinity embedded in it.
Of course,
a certain kind of, you know, what's would be considered, you know, this, you know, something beautiful and sensitive.
Yes. Sure. Kind of Blue, Sunday at the Village Vanguard. You know, there's all that stuff that I don't hear hyper masculinity in those records.
No, there's, but okay, so now we get into, but where do we dwell? You see what I mean? Of course, there's Kind of Blue, and of course, there's Coltrane's ballads, but that's not what put them on the map.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That's not where the music dwells. That's the release from the tension.
And on the other hand, Kind of Blue's like the most successful record that that was ever put out in jazz.
Yeah, probably because more women bought it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, of course, because it was more appealing to a larger amount of people.
But you said something that's so interesting, which is at this point in your life, through the lens of doing this work and helping other musicians behind you come along, and you're now looking at yourself and saying, well, what did I put away along the way? How did my playing change, maybe in an effort to sound like what I thought I was supposed to sound like or play like a man or whatever?
No, but nobody was thinking about playing like a man or anything like that. We weren't thinking in those terms. I'm saying I needed to be able to play like every other guy in New York because that was my competition.
Yes.
You see what I mean? But then you have some critics that would trash me because they said I played too loud or something. But they're not going to say the same thing to Jeff Watts.
Yeah.
So there's so many layers of this that's not ever really been addressed in general. But I'm saying if a standard has been created playing this particular instrument, the drums, by all of these guys that also like football. I mean, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know, that like wrestling, that like bullfights. I don't like any of that.
I think you kind of alluded to something earlier where you said, you know, at a certain point, you also have to confront the fact that you became a model for people. Like, I mean, a big part of the issue is if you don't see somebody paving the way, it's much harder to get there yourself. If you're a young woman or, you know, a girl, wherever, you like jazz, but all you see is a bunch of guys standing on stage, you might say, well, there's no way for me to get there. And then you become one of the role models, the people that somebody would look at and go, oh, I can't, there is a space for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the classic saying is you can't be what you don't see. Mm-hmm. But then yet again, so many of us have.
You were.
Yeah. But I think we tend to agree that you need role models. And you know, most of my role models were guys. You know, we go like into this even deeper because therein lies a whole nother issue with gender. Like, I don't know, if I were coming up now, maybe I would consider myself non-binary or, you know what I mean? All of that. But I came up in the time, there was no language for that.
I've been thinking about that as we're having this conversation right now. I mean, like, you know, I have a 13 going on 14-year-old daughter who's growing up in a world where gender is a construct and it is movable. And these kids, they don't think about boys and girls in the same way that we're talking about them.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And it's going to make a difference in society, as you well know, you know, from your experiencing your own kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's totally fascinating. But we didn't have those same opportunities, I guess you could say, to make those choices, but it was still happening. I knew that I could not let any man really intimidate me. And I knew I had to be part of the boys' club to some degree, but also found it natural. So it's like we're all trying to be free. And so I think that the thing with this, you know, gender fluidity and all of that is a way to be free. And now that's something that I think most of us have in common. So many guys are brought up in a way that it's not an option, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about freedom in that way. But with our institute, the one thing I didn't expect is for so many guys to want to join it and to reject the hyper masculinity that's embedded in this music, or to reject the bro culture, you know, that's embedded in the music. So that's interesting too, because what is that going to sound like even coming from them?
Forgive me for asking, but just explain to me how the Institute operates at Berkeley, and just like, how does it work and how do you join it and what does it mean to join it?
It's literally just handling the ensembles of the people that are in the Institute, their performance ensembles. So we have, oh goodness, I think 11 ensembles. I think we have around 60 students. It's bad with exact numbers. But basically, they take their ensembles with us. And also, our managing director, Asia Burrell Wood, she teaches a couple of liberal arts classes. One of them is Jazz, Gender, and Society. So that's one of our classes. And come September, it will be offered as a minor. So you just have to have a certain amount of credits with the classes that we offer to be a minor. So if you take her Jazz, Gender, and maybe one other non-performance class, like a research class that we're offering, and also outreach class with Boston Arts Academy. If you take two of those and then say one ensemble for 2 years each semester, that's four ensembles, you'll have done the requirements for a minor. But it's also a lot of the things that we do, partnering and activities outside of Berkeley, that are a big part of what the Institute does. So I put out a book called New Standards, 101 Lead Sheets by Women Composers. Initiatives like that, lots of panel discussions and invitations from, you know, other colleges.
It seems like a big part of what you're doing is letting this conversation keep happening. It's being discovered and worked out right now, and it has to happen on the bandstand, and it has to happen off the bandstand. It has to be normalized and okay to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the sense that that's a big part of the work, is just, we can talk about this. Let's talk about this. It's important to address it.
Yeah, it's important to talk about it and to also challenge, help, encourage people to expand in their thinking about it. Because if you have a band and it's all guys, I would eventually like for people to see that, you know, is that the world you want to live in? You know, like, is there a way for you to represent, you know, a more equitable world on your stage, mm-hmm. and not, you know, women in obligatory roles as background singers or in a cute outfit? Because that's what we have the opportunity to do when we have platforms. So, you know, the kind of world we want to live in. I mean, some people are okay with that. I'm not, you know, but at least I know that's what you're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, if we have the conversation, or you know, at this point, you don't have to have it even to kind of know. It's like you're basically prescribing to, even if it's not conscious, you're prescribing to, I want to play with my bros, use the, you know, my friends, and this is how, my world. Or even, you know, when it comes to diversity of other kinds, it's kind of like, this is how I'm comfortable. This is what's fun for me. I mean, you know, it should be fun to a degree, but we're hopefully at getting to a place where we're doing this to change the world and to, you know, do something greater than just have fun.
Okay, great. This is a great way for us to talk about We Insist 2025. We're doing this to change the world. And again, it happens in the music, and it happens in the way the music gets played. And a big part of what I'm hearing you say is actually, it's like, it's not just that the music has to change. We have to change as people, mm-hmm. as a society, we have to change. It requires a shift in our thinking. And in order for the music to move forward, we have to move forward as a society. And it's, and in order for us to, you know, I mean, they go hand in hand. Okay. So now mm-hmm. it's not the first time you've done this, but you revisited, in this case, you're revisiting Max Roach's record that came out either in 1960 or 1961. I was just thinking about it because, you know, it came out a handful of years before you arrived on this planet. Mm-hmm. And it was addressing a reality of the moment. So here you are, all these years later, revisiting We Insist, the music. You added music to it. It was a short suite, only five songs originally. You've doubled that. When did you decide you wanted to do this and that it now was the time to do this?
I think it was an idea just floating around in my head over the years to some degree, because I was in a few different situations where I arranged Freedom Day.
I saw you did it with Liz Wright 2 or 3 years ago. I saw a video mm-hmm. of that, of mm-hmm. a version of that.
Yeah, I've done it before with some others too. And then I started working with Candid Records. My records come out on Candid, but I also started doing A&R for Candid. So I start thinking about the label and their story and all of that. Of course, this record, the original one, came out on Candid. And then Max Roach's Centennial came into place. And so I had the idea earlier in the year about doing Max Roach tribute album, you know, celebrating his centennial with five different drummers doing Freedom Now Suite, me and four other drummers. That was my original idea, but I never got around to it.
Do you mind me asking who the other drummers you would have called would have been? Did you know who you wanted to call?
I wrote a bunch of names down, yeah. But I never focused in on exactly who. And then, I don't know, August rolled around. I was like, oh my God, the year is almost over, and I didn't do anything. And Max was, you know, very important to me. He was very encouraging. He tried to get me a record deal on Blue Note when I was 16 or so, 15 or 16, which means a lot to me because nobody else did, you know, like not one other soul. So I really did want to celebrate him. So I thought, well, I need to do this very fast. And I don't want to now turn it into a drummer project because that'll take too much time and then I'll be on other people's schedules. So I need to do this more succinctly. I had been working some with Christy Dashiell and I just felt like she would be the perfect person to reinterpret these songs with a certain kind of sound of today that blends jazz. I mean, she's a bona fide jazz singer, but she also has roots in the church and gospel and R&B is part of her sound as well. So however these songs were going to be arranged, I knew she could do justice to them. And I started thinking about all the artists that I had been working with, bringing them to Candid. Morgan Guerin, Elena Casado.
Simon
Mouillet, and Matthew Stevens, who were recording his record this weekend for Candid too.
Oh, nice.
That's really how it all started. And I thought, all these people I know fairly well, and doing it like this, it naturally points to their Candid records as well. So it's kind of like a Candid family album. And I knew that I could rely on all of them to show up, get it done quickly. If I need some overdubs, get those done. It was really about time at this point, because I really wanted a single at least to come out before his centennial was over. And that didn't happen, but it's okay.
Is there any part of you that feels like it's the right time in our country to be revisiting this suite and talking about this?
Yeah, obviously, when I started this project, I wasn't thinking about that so much because I thought I knew who would become president. But my timing was good in this sense because I do think it, in some ways, you know, yeah, addressing the freedoms that we're dealing with now. Of course, there's overlap with the freedoms they were dealing with in the early 60s. But there's also a new set of freedoms, which is why I added the extra tracks to enter, you know, some other ideas on freedom.
I think it sounds like it's a beautifully produced record, and a record that really can live in a couple of spaces, like you talk about Christy's ability to live in the jazz space, but also to bring the church and the contemporary sounds with her. I think the whole record is kind of like that. It's going to be interesting to, you know, a bunch of different people. And that's hard to achieve. I think a lot of times when jazz artists, particularly, or people that live in a jazz space, try to do a commercial thing or a pop thing or whatever, you can smell it on it sometimes. It's not, you know, and this just feels like, wow, this could really land, you know.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think you have to be authentic to yourself. And I've always lived a bit in those spaces that overlap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've never really been a purist. So at the end of the day, I'm just being honest and trying to make projects that have a cohesiveness, because, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, sort of triggered from my early recordings when I was told, you know, by the major labels that I didn't have a cohesiveness, you know.
Oh, interesting.
So I've, you know, tended to embrace themes.
Yeah. Because it's helpful to just, like, give it a sense of solidity or unity.
Yeah.
Cohesion.
Yeah, exactly. But even if I weren't, you know, even if I didn't do a theme, it might be a theme in my head that kind of is the glue to me. But this one is an obvious theme, of course.
When you're walking into a project, how much thinking are you doing, and when are you doing it, about the sound of the drums themselves?
Like,
tighten up the drums, have it be roomier, more resonant. Like your bass drum on this record, on the tunes that I heard, it's a tighter sound. Sometimes, you know, you'll have a more sort of bebop-y sound. Sometimes it'll be a much more funk-focused sound. When are you thinking about what you want the drums to sound like?
Not early enough. I'm always fighting with it after the fact. I'm always in a hurry, always rushing, never have enough money. You know what I mean? Trying to do champagne projects on a beer budget. So lots happens in post-production. So the two songs you heard, okay, so the second song, Driver Man, you heard as a second one, right? That one I ended up playing on a different kit. You know, we recorded the album in a couple of days.
Yeah, wow.
And but that one, I didn't really get the dance I wanted. Pretty much everything else is what happened.
Yeah.
What I normally do is just play it down a few times, and then always, you know, to a playlist and with a click, and then just kind of go between the playlists, try to pick the track that feels the best, and then wherever I don't like something, just go between the playlists. So that wasn't working for Driver Man. And also there was just something too heavy with the electric guitar playing that ostinato. So I went back and recorded acoustic guitar with Matt on the ostinato, and then I replayed the drums and had a lighter approach, actually. So that's, the kick is going to sound different. The drums in general, but the kick, especially the kick, is going to sound different on Driver Man. But, I mean, we have, you know, I even tried to replace that kick with, because I've done that so often on so many of my records, replace the kick drum.
With a sample.
Yeah, with a sample of one of mine from another song.
Yeah.
But that one didn't really work on this one. Or, and also use it to trigger another kick drum, so you could be hearing two at the same time, just to add weight, a little weight to it or something like that. So lots of, you know, the small things in post that I spend time on to make the statement that I'm trying to make. But the drums you heard in Freedom Day, those are the drums that are on most of the album.
You said earlier, after working with Herbie and Wayne, who didn't say very much, that you realized when you started running your own bands, and I suspect as a producer also, you do say stuff. You are specific about what you're looking for. You have a thing you're chasing.
Yeah. But then, you know, you have to realize when, you know, you're at the point of not getting the return that you're looking for. So you have to let people bring what they bring to the table, and know that you're constantly trying to put your vision on them. I mean, sometimes I'll just keep going, you know, with my vision, and it works. I finally get it right. But other times I know, okay, this is, they're diminishing returns now.
Yeah.
So let me just let this go.
And how has doing A&R influenced your thinking about making records in general? I mean, now you're one of the people, you're a gatekeeper in a way. You're somebody who can help an artist make a record or not. A lot of the people you are working with are people that you know already, well, or have worked with, but you know, how do you even manage that? Think about who to sign.
Yeah, I wouldn't say gatekeeper only because it's not my label. Yeah. At the end of the day, John Burke has the final decision. I just bring projects that I think are cool, and you know, I bought some that he's not gone for. Huh. And then he's signed also other people that I have nothing to do with. So, you know, so being an A&R consultant, it gives me an opportunity to help some people that I believe in. But yeah, I mean, I think deep down, I always wanted to do that because I felt like it was mostly lawyers doing that gig. And I know that they don't know as much as us. I'm not about the artistic end. They may get into like what's going to sell, what they think is going to sell. But I mean, even Clive Davis started off as an attorney. So at what point do these attorneys become the end, all-knowing musical people? That has always bothered me from the time I read the book Hitman.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes.
I'm like, these lawyers are running this show.
Yeah. I much prefer you to be running the show, Terry Lynn Carrington. Congratulations on the new record. I think it's a beautiful project, and I can't wait for you to share this with more people. And I just appreciate you taking time to talk to me today. It's such a great pleasure to get to chat a little bit.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. And please, I played with your father on a TV show back in the 80s. I think there's a clip of it online. I did an interview, and then we played, but I can't remember who else was there.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to put this out the week that the record comes out.
Thank you, and tell your dad hello.
I absolutely will. He'll be delighted. He'll be so thrilled that you remember that.
Of course. All right.
Take care.
Well. Thanks, right. Leo. Bye-bye.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.